Okay, today's scripture reading is Colossians 3, 1 through 17. Since then, you have raised with Christ, set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things. For you died, and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature: sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry. Because of these, the wrath of God is coming. You used to walk in these ways in the life you once lived, but now you must also rid yourselves of all such things as these: anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips. Do not lie to each other, since you have taken off your old self with practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. Here there is no Gentile or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, or free, but Christ is all and is in all. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Bear with each other and forgive one another. If any of you has a grievance against someone, forgive as the Lord forgave you. And over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, since as members of one body you were called to peace. And be thankful. Let the message of Christ dwell among you richly as you teach and admonish one another with all wisdom through psalms, hymns, and songs from the Spirit, singing to God with gratitude in your hearts. And whatever you do, whether in word or deed, do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him.
So last fall, I was passing through Columbus, visited a friend of mine from Washington, D.C., and just over supper, he started telling me about the church he was attending. And it was, I could tell, it was, I was like, this is an interesting place. It didn't sound like your typical church. And he also started telling me about the ministry that was that is out of that church and connected with that church, and how he had done, he's a fantastic cook, and he had put on an annual meal to raise money. So kind of planted a seed in my mind, and a few months later, I contacted them about just trying to figure out how we might be able to support this ministry. And one thing led to another, and Tim and Beth ended up at our house a couple months ago. And it was we got in our living room just a snapshot of a world I think we all are, most of us are aware is happening, yet many of us, it seems quite distant, or it seems very foreign, or it seems like it's happening somewhere else. And it was just a very eye-opening experience for me. And so I asked them if they would come through when I had a week off from preaching so that we could hear their story. We could hear about how a faith community is responding to the opioid crisis and human trafficking, issues that were and problems we're aware of, but again, we don't always hear about how faith communities are responding to that. So I want to welcome Tim and Beth and Taylor, who are here from Columbus, and they're going to tell you, you're going to hear the story. Those of us in Sunday school heard some really sobering statistics, to be honest with you. And we're going to, I think we'll probably hear some of that too, but we're also going to hear now today more about some of their response to those sobering realities in Columbus. So I want to welcome you. And Tim is a pastor at the church on Como. And then Taylor and Beth both work directly with the ministry, which is also called Como, Compassion Outreach Ministries of Ohio. Good. All right. So welcome. We are very pleased to have you with us here. Thank you for joining us. So welcome, Tim and Taylor and Beth. If you need to adjust the mics to your...
Good morning, everyone. My name's Tim. What's yours? Go ahead. Okay, well, nice to meet you. Here's a problem. I have trouble remembering names anyway, so I might as well just get introduced to everybody at the same time. So let me tell you what we're going to try to do today in the time we have. I'm going to give you a quick version of our story and kind of how we got there. Then we're going to make some hard turns. I say it that way because I don't set my wife up very well, and it gives me an excuse. And I'm going to make a hard turn and bring Beth up here, and she's going to tell you about our recovery program. And then she's going to kind of lead into Taylor, who's going to tell you about what we do in human trafficking. And so I'm going to lead you up to that, how we got into this. So the story starts with a Bible study we wanted to do with our kids because they were a sophomore, junior, and senior in high school. And we wanted them to understand how God's will works, because when I was a kid, I grew up in church. I'm a third-generation pastor. I had this idea of God's will that was just a straight line, and if I ever veered off of it, then I was done. And I don't know, nobody ever preached that, right? But we talked about God's perfect will, and it was like, if you missed it, you were done. You know, you had to spend the rest of your life and just going to church and being miserable, I guess, which might happen anyway, but let's not. So this book, Experiencing God, talks about God's will being from eternity to eternity, and it's not a small thing, but a really, really big thing. And instead of it being just me in God, it's God working and me joining God in his work. You know, because God's already at work. God's at work wherever you're at. God's at work whatever community you're in. And our job is to find that and join God in that work. And we want our kids to know that. So we started the Bible study. And, you know, we gave them these books where they had to do Bible study. And, you know, these are high school students. They had to do Bible study 5 days a week, and then we had our personally, and then we'd meet together on Sunday, and they really liked the idea. Teenagers love the idea of having to do their own Bible study for 45 minutes a day. But our Bible study led to something else, where finally some friends come over later that year, and we said, hey, God might be at work in this. And so we asked the kids if they wanted to extend their Bible study to friends at school. And we started it, and people started showing up at our house every Sunday night. And we'd feed them, we'd show them a video, and we'd have these breakout groups, and the kids started calling this home church. Well, we thought, well, that's a great thing, but we need to get them in a real church, you know, building. And I was working with my brother in the south end of Columbus, and we lived in the north end, and we could never get anybody there to go there. And so eventually, Beth convinced me that we needed to start a church, which I had no desire to do. But when you get to know Beth, you understand that it doesn't really matter. There's plenty of husbands here that understand that. But, you know, my background, and this is important for us, my background is churched. I've always been churched. I grew up in church, you know, and I've always had that. Beth did not come from that background. And my limitations, my understanding, you know, kind of always fell, as much as I wanted to, they fell inside these four walls. You know, but home church was different. Here I am, a third-generation pastor with a master's degree, and when it come to home church, obviously all these kids wanted to hear me talk. Right? No. That's when I started cooking a lot. And that's all I could do. What we wanted to do is, there's this book called I Once Was Lost. And when I grew up, and some of you grew up, people were familiar with the church. They were familiar with what it meant to be at church. They were familiar with Christianity. And we would do things, and we'd do things in my community called revivals, and people would come to revivals, and people would come forward, you know, and that's, you know, that's the way people came to Christ. But we're four generations removed, actually, from us being a country that really understands that a whole lot. And so these guys wrote this book called I Once Was Lost, and he said there's five thresholds now for people to cross before they cross the line of faith. And the first threshold is they have to learn to trust the Christian. Because the world doesn't trust Christians, just in case you missed that. Just in case you haven't watched TV lately, people don't trust Christians. And so our goal at the house was to just create a safe space for these people to trust Christians. And so our house, we would do church on Sunday morning. There would be a handful of people there. We would come home on Sunday afternoon. Home church started at 6:30, something like that. At 1 o'clock, there would already be kids at our house. And they would just filter in all day. We'd have about 30 to 50 kids, teenagers, and we'd live on a court in a neighborhood. And they were tattooed, pierced, engaged. Just if you don't know what that means, you can see it on TV. And they all started coming to our house. They'd be double parked. They'd be standing all over our court, you know, smoking and stuff out in our court, you know. And we're in a regular suburban neighborhood. Not like we was in a country where we had land. We had a lot, you know. And we'd have 40 kids there every Sunday night. We started the church, and it was just kind of going along slowly. But home church just kept going. One night, these three guys that are home church leaders who led small groups because people would listen to them, they come to us and they said, we want to have a meeting with you. Well, I wasn't really interested in having a meeting on Sunday night because Sunday after, you know, going to church, going through the weekend, you know, I'd prepare food in the afternoon, and we'd do home church. We'd be with all these people. I'd take them home so they'd get out of our house. I'd put them in my car, start stuffing them in there. So, okay, we're done. It's time for you to go home. That's actually what I did on Sunday nights. And when I left the last person off, I was like, oh, just, you know. And these three guys said, we want to talk with you and Beth. So we go in our basement, and I'm like, I don't want to hear what these guys have to say. Because, you know, mostly us pastors have really big hearts, but not Sunday nights. And sorry, that's a little insight. They said, we want you to rent us a house. And here's these three guys, 18 to like 22, that are asking us, who don't have any money because we're pastors, to rent them a house. And I was like, there is no way we're going to rent. And Beth said, well, I've been praying about that. So we rented them a house. And we started to think a men's ministry house. And the goal here was that they could live out their faith in community because they couldn't live it out at home in the situations they were in. And we opened it with five guys. And so they could do that. We're just trying to help them along. Home church is going on. I need to shorten my time so you can hear the others. But one other thing happened as we were doing that. One night, three of our home church leaders show up at our house. And by this time, we got our two daughters at home. And there's this guy, and they say, hey, Matt's just high out of his mind. He can't stay at his parents' house. None of our parents will have him anymore. Can he stay at your house tonight? Now, Beth, they tell this to Beth, and I'm sitting on my couch. The last time I ever sat on my couch, by the way. And I'm thinking, I got two daughters. And this is Friday. And Saturday is a mess, and then Sunday is what Sunday is with home church. We're Monday off. This guy's not leaving until Tuesday. And I'm going to let this guy who's high come in my house. And then I thought, well, he's not going to hurt anybody. He's that high. So anybody who's ever let someone move in with them for a short period of time, it's never what they say. Just a little help. And so we did. We helped. We moved him right in, and we moved him out 9 months later. We actually did a dirty trick. We took him to college and dropped him off. And he thought college was the best meal plan he'd ever had because he certainly didn't go to class. But he was out of our house. But what that did then, we began to get people who from home church and stuff that were dealing with drugs and opiates and things like that. And we began to try to find out how we could do something for that. And one night, Beth sits up and she says, I know where we can rent a house to start our recovery program. I'm like, oh, we're going to start a recovery program. And so that's kind of how we got started. I want to give them more time, so I'm going to do a hard turn and kind of let Beth take it from there. And we'll have to leave you guys open for questions or something later. So go ahead.
Hi. Should I pull it down? I don't want to squeak or anything. Oh, that's good. That's fine. So, my name is Beth, and I oversee our nonprofit, Compassion Outreach Ministries of Ohio, but I primarily run our recovery program. And so I'm just going to read this really horrible statistic to start out, just because that's usually, you know, cheerful. And then I'll kind of tell you what we do. Drug overdoses, in 2017, drug overdoses killed 72,000 Americans. That is more people than died combined with HIV, car crashes, and gun deaths totally combined. So 2017, 72,000 Americans died of drug overdoses. That's horrific. When I read that, like all combined together, I was sick. I just couldn't even believe it. And so on a whole, like, why do we do this or what do we do? I first just want to say that I believe that the answer to the opiate crisis is the church. I think that the government has a lot of good ideas. I think that the church should work with the government. I believe that there's a lot of social services that can help. But I really believe that the only hope that we have in beating this opiate crisis is the church. I believe that we are the answer. And so because I believe that, here's what we did. Like Tim said, we brought this guy home, and more people with addiction just seemed to find, I guess they found our address and came to our house. I'm not really sure how it all started. Just people that were on drugs found us. And the common thread that we found with people that found us was they had been to rehab a lot of times. They'd been in and out of 30, 60, 90-day rehabs a lot, just again and again and again and again, and it just wasn't working. And so they just are like, hey, can you help us? And as people of faith, we just said, yeah, we probably should. So we started this program. And when we started out, it's a long-term faith-based residential recovery program. It's private, and it is free. So we started this thing. We thought, well, we're going to take people into our homes for about 6 months, and we'll figure out what to do with them. We'll teach them some life skills, teach them some how to cope with their emotions, just different things, and then we're just going to like get them a job and a car and a phone and just send them out, and everything will be good. But that didn't work that way. So through a bunch of trial and error, we now have a residential recovery program that is long-term. And long-term currently means for us between 18 and 24 months. And that's the average stay with us. And it's kind of getting longer and longer and longer, so we're trying to figure out how to get it back to 2 years, because 2 years is a really long time to live with somebody, actually. So what that means for us, a long-term faith-based residential recovery program, is people come to us that have failed every other place that there is. They've exhausted their parents' money, they've bankrupted them, they've stole from them, they're homeless, they have nothing. The people that we get ultimately are just about the bottom of the barrel. These are probably not people you would want to bring home to your house and live with. We have people that have been in the court system, in and out of the court system. Recently, we're doing a good job. We've been able to have the privilege of working with some felony one and felony two people instead of going to prison, which that's like kind of significant because felony one and felony two are long-term prison sentences. So it's kind of really neat to see how God's been able to work through us through the court system and allow us to be an alternative to prison sometimes. And so what that looks like when people come to us, they surrender their phone, which they generally don't have, or they have like a little burner flip phone. They surrender their phone, their car, their job, their money, and all of their freedom for the duration of the program. And they come and they live, like actually live in our house. So Tim and I have the Women's Beginning House, where women come into us between 18 and 36. It was 30, but now it's 30. It's, you know, more people are getting older. 18 and 36, and they stay with us for 12 to 14 months. And during that period of time, they never leave our sight. When Tim says he doesn't sit on his couch, he's telling you the truth. Our house is packed full of women. Well, it's not. I guess there's, what, 8 of us right now? Tim lives with 8 women. 8 women who are probably have the emotional age of 14. So when addiction, when people get active in their addiction, their emotional age abruptly comes to a halt. So we live in junior high school in our house. Like, if I get a piece of gum, you better get a piece of gum, you know? I'm actually not kidding. Okay, so women live with us. We detox women, and they live with us 12 to 14 months, or however long it takes them to complete everything that they need to complete, and then they move to the women's intermediate house, and that's where Taylor and her husband live. And they will stay there for right around 6 to 8 months, and then they would graduate the program. And you're like, well, what are they doing all this time? Here's what we found. We started our program. We decided we took like a survey of everybody that kept come that God kept bringing to us, and we said, what is not working? Everything that wasn't working, we threw out. Everything that does work, we brought in. We're considered a therapeutic community in which everything is peer-led. So in order to work for us or to be a participant in our recovery program, you have to have a shared experience. Because addiction is kind of crafty, you know. People that are active in addiction are liars, cheaters, manipulators, are master manipulators, they're thieves. And if you do not have a shared experience, they're probably going to pull the wool over your eyes. So everybody that works in our program is in recovery, in various stages of recovery. We pulled in every resource. We learned, we studied, we got every resource known to mankind. We use clinical stuff, and we use secular stuff, we use Christian materials, we use everything, because that's what it takes to beat addiction. And so we started out, you know, like I said, you know, teaching people to work or just to get along in community, and we found out that that wasn't enough. We found that we had to get people from an emotional age of 14 to match their chronological age. Good luck, right? You know, people that live with us really, I think, were raised by packs of wolves. That's true. But not really. You know, I mean, statistically speaking, these are people from affluent white communities. And they're like, well, how did you get from, you know, this wonderful community and wonderful parents, and now you're a person who's emotional age of 12, and I have to teach you to cut your meat and not eat your food out of a can? That's true. I don't know. I don't know. I know that the drugs change people's brains, and they stop and they don't learn anymore. And so we spend all of our days, when Tim says people are with us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, they really are. If I want to have a day off, I got to go barricade myself in my room and, you know, tell them, do not knock on my door. So this sounds like it's like really horrible, right? But this is the best job I could ever have. I get to watch God transform people from the most broken person that you would ever meet in your whole entire life to brand new. How we do it, I don't know. I really don't. I know God restores people every single day. A lot of people that come to us have no faith, and by the time they leave us, they still have just maybe a little bit of faith. But they know that through our faith, God can and will make them new. And it's amazing. Interestingly enough, we are right now, and don't tell anybody this because I'm afraid it'll change. Right now, we have about the best statistic in the United States for success. We have a 92% success rate for sustained recovery over 5 years. That's amazing. The average success rate is between 2 and 3%. 92% of our graduates are clean and sober, which means one guy had to upset the apple cart. If I could find him, I'd wring his neck. But that is huge. We have about a 70% retention rate, so 70% of the people that come to us stay with us. It is phenomenal. It is phenomenal to watch somebody go from the most broken that you could possibly be to be fully restored. And I'll be here to answer any questions if you want to know more about it, but I really want to get my daughter up here. One of the things that we found, and she's going to explain to you a little bit more, is of our women that are in our program, 100% have been human trafficked. And so we wanted to address that as well, and I'm going to bring up Taylor, and she's going to tell you how we do that.
Hi, go. My mom thought that when I left her house, or when I was at least out of middle school, that she would not have to deal with 14-year-olds anymore. It's not real. Thankfully, it's just not me. So my name is Taylor, and I also work for Como. And like my mom said, once we have this recovery program, and we service men and women, and through a lot, I mean, we've been doing this recovery program for many years now, and we were very unaware of the connection between human trafficking and the opiate epidemic for quite some time. And over the last couple years, Columbus specifically, and a lot of big cities have started kind of talking about what this looks like and what human trafficking is and how the community and the nation needs to respond. And when we kind of started to hear about this, our women started to tell us, well, I was trafficked, or, you know, I was sold, and this happened to me. And it turns out that every woman who's ever come through our doors has been trafficked. And we didn't know really what that meant, to be honest with you. Has anybody ever seen the movie Taken with Liam Neeson? So when I heard about human trafficking, I thought it was this industry that happened in different countries, and girls were being sold, you know, in Europe and in Asia, but that America was immune, or at least it didn't look like the movie. And our response to the human trafficking issue has been a long journey. For a long time, we kind of tossed around ideas of what to do and how to do it, but one thing remained true, and I think that they said this: we are not the staff at Como, we're not heroes. We don't do anything special. The only thing we've done is respond to what God has called us to do. And what God has called us to do is to step into the mess. So when we stepped into the mess of the opiate epidemic, we just literally just tried anything. And when God was calling us into the mess of the human trafficking issue, we just said okay, and we stepped in. And we started to see this problem because we have all of these girls coming to us because they want to get sober and they want to stop using drugs and they want to change their life. And then months down their line of recovery, they're admitting that they were trafficked, or they're just now realizing that they were trafficked. Because for many girls, it was their parents that sold them, or their brother, or a boyfriend. So a lot of the times we have to educate these women on what human trafficking is, and they're like, oh, I didn't know that happened to me. I didn't know I was a statistic. So we have all of these girls coming to us and saying, I want to be different, I want to be new, and I want to be sober, and oh, by the way, I was trafficked. And that raised a red flag for us. If we're getting girls coming to us because of their addiction, how many girls are still out on the streets being trafficked currently? And how many of them can't get from the street to recovery? How do you make that happen? And that's a pretty daunting task, right? And when we talk about human trafficking, we're talking about one of the cruelest and most evil industries in the world. Literally selling other human beings. And if you have that, and you have all these women who have so much trauma and shame and guilt, how do you move them into a place of acceptance and love and health? It seems nearly impossible. And when me and my mom started to talk about what it would look like and what we should do, and to be honest, we were tasked with the job of responding to human trafficking. Two men named Joe Duvall and Tom Hermes, they our heads in our district, approached Como and said, you need to do something. And we're like, oh, okay, sure. Well, I don't know why us, but yeah. And we all started to talk about what this looked like. And we did some research, and we found that Columbus has a lot of things, and one of the main resources for human trafficking victims are things called drop-in centers. And these are places where women or men, if they're being trafficked, can come and get resources and get connected to, rescue resources and clothes and things like that. And we decided that maybe we should join that fight. Maybe we should do something kind of similar. But when we started to do research about what these drop-in centers looked like, and we were seeing all of these women who were in recovery, but we knew that there were thousands of girls still being trafficked, the resources didn't look like enough. A lot of drop-in centers only open once a month, or they only are able to provide small meals or some snack bags and some maybe some food and a couple shirts. And I can't take credit for this. This is all my mom, actually. When we just decided to open this drop-in center, she goes, I don't want to be one of those that places that is just barely scraping by and can provide the basic minimum needs for these girls. She goes, I want to be a home for these girls. And when you begin a home, you start to think of, well, what do you have in a home? When you walk into your house, what do you see? What do you feel? What makes you feel safe? And we started to toss around ideas and started to think about the things that these girls lacked, right? If you're living on a street, what do you not have? Well, one of those things is a shower. If you live on the street, you kind of smell sometimes. And if you're living on the street and you have two shirts to your name, you probably want to wash those shirts, right? You don't have a washer and dryer on a porch. You got to have a place to wash your clothes. And when we started to meet all these girls, we started to see how small and malnourished and skinny they were. We said, we have to feed them big meals that put some pounds on these girls. And ultimately, we wanted to be a place that these women can walk through the doors and feel love and acceptance. In a place where they can begin to learn and to realize that they are not property. They are not worth money, and they have not been forgotten. But they are loved, and they are cherished. And there is a way to get from the street to being rescued, and to being sober, and healthy, and happy. That it is possible. It's hard, but it's possible. And our response has been nothing amazing, to be honest with you. The only thing that we do at our Women's Drop-In Center is open our doors, love women who come in who don't feel love, who don't have love. And when they start to talk about their experiences and then what has happened to them, we're able to look at them and say, we know you are worth it. And we love you. And we are going to be here until the day you decide to change your life. Now, statistically, at the Women's Respite Center, we see 150 women a week. We're told we haven't scratched the surface. Of the women that we see, we get a lot of regulars. And when I say regulars, I mean people we see. We're open 3 days a week. We see some women 3 days a week. And they come in every time. We're the only source of food. We're the only source of any resources at all. And we know statistically that out of the 150 women that we see, many of them, a majority of them, will die on the streets in Columbus. They will not live long enough to make it out to get rescue resources. There's just not enough. And that's a hard reality that we have to face every day, is that every woman who comes into our doors, it might be the last time that we see them. But we are a people of hope. And we are a people that know that God can change lives, because thankfully we get to see it. And we know that it happens. And getting somebody from the streets of Columbus who has been trafficked since they were a little girl into recovery is a hard task. But what it takes is people to just reach out their hands, put their hands in the dirt, and say, I love you. Whether you're sober, whether you're trafficked, whether you want to stay in this lifestyle or not, we are here to love you until you die or you take our hand and cross the bridge from point A to point B. And like I said, we're not heroes. All we did was respond to what God has called us to do. And the only thing that we did was we were blessed with a house. We were blessed with resources to be able to do this. We're just the hands and the feet that just happened to be the ones that opened the door and to hand some shirts out and help women shower and to give them what they need. And everybody can do something about the human trafficking problem and the opiate epidemic problem. And that is simply to step into it and learn about it and to accept that the people that are there and the people that we're dealing with, they need help and they need love. And the church is the answer because we have hope. We get to see the issues and we know it doesn't end there. Thank you guys so much for having us and for getting to hear all the sad, sad things that we get to do, but also knowing that good things do happen. Thank you.
Yesterday we spoke at an opiate conference and each of us had about an hour or so apiece. We can really depress you. but what's happened for us this week is we had a graduation on Thursday. And our graduation, guys, man, it would be good to bring a bus to a graduation because it is a celebration of a life transformation. And the guy who graduated, this is the first time I ever did it for one guy, but he was married and he had a daughter. You know, and to see a family reconciled and his life changed like that, you just don't see transformation like that. And it just affirms, you know, that God's in that kind of work. And I think about Taylor has a story that she tells that she didn't have time for today that I just weep about one of the girls in the drop-in center, and I think, I can't believe I get to be part of this stuff. You know, of people, of seeing that kind of life transformation. I wanted to introduce a couple things to you, and I don't know why I am, because I don't really have the resources to give them to you. But another church prepared this thing, it's three, for the drop-in center, because we need resources all the time, and things like travel soap and stuff like that, and jeans. And so if they have 150 girls coming in a week, and each of them takes a pair of jeans, there's 150 pairs of jeans that go out that door that week, right? And so stuff like that. And this brochure tells stuff that, you know, if you want to get involved, you know, with us, there's things you can donate and things like that along that. I have one brochure. I'm going to give it to your pastor. Should I give it to him or somebody else I should give it to? Because if you're in my church, please don't give this to me, especially after church, because I'm shaking hands. I don't know where it's going to end up. I'll just leave it right here. And then I do have some of these. These cards are just ways to be involved with us. And the one I really want to point you to is the prayer team. We have a prayer team that gets a monthly newsletter via email. And it just has three prayer requests. It has, I do a little bit of a story. And I just let you know what's going on. And usually we highlight one of the stories from the program in there. It's a monthly email that you don't have to take a lot of time with to read. But it keeps you connected and lets you know what to pray for. And so really, if you'd like to be part of that, you can grab one of these cards, you know, put your name and your email on it. And there's other ways you want to be involved. You can also do that. I have the cards with me, and I can leave some here too. But we really appreciate people just joining us in prayer for this. Because one other thing that we don't talk about a lot is that we have, I don't know, five or six staff. I don't know why I can't keep track of it. But, yeah, because one of our guys just left. You're talking millennials, and millennials get a real bad rap. But these people work 24 hours a day, pretty much, 6 days a week, and they make a sum, you know, we take care of everything for them, and they make $50 a week, and they live on that. You know, and they live on that because they're committed to that kind of work. And so we really rely on prayer to get through that stuff, you know. But God does that work. And so if you're interested in being, you know, and being a part of that, we'd love to have you as part of the prayer team. And one other thing, you might be interested in, if you're on that thing on the Facebook or something, and you don't have to. You can get it via email too. Beth does a blog, a regular blog, and she she tells stories about what her life is like and people at the program, and they're really just kind of Beth talking a lot, and they're a lot of fun. And she gives the people nicknames that reflect who they are in our program. And so if you're interested in that too, you know, you can get that via Facebook or something like that, but you can put that down here and we'll make sure you get that. And that's basically all I wanted to tell you about how you could be connected with us. And we really appreciate you guys taking the time to hear what we had to say. We'd love to talk to you after church.
Thank you guys so much for being with us and sharing this story, and it's been a powerful experience. He did say, Tim said, if you have questions, they're going to probably hang. They'll be in the back there to greet people as they go out. But I just want to encourage you, feel free. I know they're open to talking with you, asking questions, so feel free to talk to them after the service. But thank you guys so much.